Chapter 2. The acquaintance was not slow in coming. With naval promptness, Admiral Haddock invited the ladies of Mapes to dine with the newcomers, and presently Captain Aubrey and Dr. Maturin were asked to dinner at Mapes. They were pronounced excellent young men, most agreeable company, perfectly well-bred, and a great addition to the neighbourhood. It was clear to Sophia, however, that poor Dr. Maturin needed feeding properly. He was quite pale and silent, she said. But even the tenderest heart, the most given to pity, couldn't have said the same for Jack. He was in great form from even the beginning of the party, when his laugh was to be heard coming up the drive, until the last repeated farewells under the freezing portico. His fine, open, battle-scarred countenance had worn either a smile or a look of lively pleasure from the first to the last. And although his blue eye had dwelt a little wistfully upon the stationary decanter and the disappearing remains of the pudding, his cheerful flow of small but perfectly amiable talk had never faltered. He had eaten everything set before him with grateful voracity, and even Mrs. Williams felt something like an affectionate leaning towards him. "Well," she said, as their hoofbeats died away in the night, "I believe that was as successful a dinner party as I have ever given. Captain Aubrey managed a second partridge, but then they were so very tender, and the floating island looked particularly well in the silver bowl. There'll be enough for tomorrow, and the rest of the pork will be delicious, hashed. How well they ate, to be sure! I don't suppose they often have a dinner like that. I wonder at the Admiral saying that Captain Aubrey was not quite the thing. I think he's very much the thing. Sophie, my love, pray tell John to put the port the gentleman left into a small bottle at once before he locks up. It's bad for the decanter to leave port wine in it."
"Yes, Mamma."
"Now, my dears," whispered Mrs. Williams, having left a significant pause after the closing of the door, "I dare say you all noticed Captain Aubrey's great interest in Sophia. He was quite particular. I have little doubt that... I think it would be very nice if we were all to leave them alone together as much as possible. Are you attending, Diana?"
"Oh, yes, ma'am, I understand you perfectly well," said Diana, turning back from the window.
Far over in the moonlit night the pale road wound between Polkerry and Beacon Down, and the horsemen were walking briskly up it.
I wonder,
said Jack, "whether there's any goose left at home, or whether those infernal brutes have eaten it up. At all events, we can have an omelette and a bottle of claret." Claret! Have you ever known a woman that had any notion of wine?
I have not.
And damn near with the pudding, too. But what charming girls they are! Did you notice the eldest one, Miss Williams, holding up her wine glass and looking at the candle through it? Such grace! The tapered of her wrist and hand, long, long fingers.
Stephen Maturin was scratching himself with a dogged perseverance he was not attending, but Jack went on,
"And that Mrs. Villers, how beautifully she held her head, lovely colouring. Perhaps not such a perfect complexion as her cousin, she's been in India, I believe, but what deep blue eyes! How old would she be, Stephen?"
"Not 30.
I remember well how she sat her horse. By God, a year or two back I should have... How a man changes. But even so, I do love being surrounded by girls, so very different from men. She said several handsome things about the service, spoke very sensibly, thoroughly understood the importance of the weather gauge. She must have naval connections. I do hope we see her again. I hope we see them all again."
They saw her again, and sooner than they had expected. Mrs. Williams, too, just happened to be passing by Melbury, and she directed Thomas to turn up the well-known drive. A deep and powerful voice, the other side of the door, was singing, "You ladies of lubricity that dwell in the bordello, ha 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 he, for I am that kind of fellow." But the ladies walked into the hall quite unmoved, since not one of them except Diana understood the words, and she was not easily upset. With great satisfaction they noticed that the servant who let them in had a pigtail halfway down his back, that the parlour into which he showed them was disappointingly trim. It might have been spring-cleaned that morning, reflected Mrs. Williams, drawing her finger along the top of the wainscot. The only thing that distinguished it from an ordinary Christian parlour was the rigid formation of the chairs, squared to one another like the yards of a ship, and the bell-pull, which was 3 fathoms of cable, wormed and served, and ending in a brass-bound top-block. The powerful voice stopped, and it occurred to Diana that someone's face must be going red. It was indeed highly coloured when Captain Aubrey came hurrying in, but he didn't falter as he cried, "Why, this is most neighbourly, truly kind. A very good afternoon to you, ma'am. Mrs. Villiers, Miss Williams, your servant, Miss Cecilia, Miss Francis, how happy I am to see you. Pray, step into the—" "We just happened to be passing by," said Mrs. Williams, "and I thought we might just stop for a moment to ask how the jasmine is thriving." "Jasmine?" cried Jack. "Yes," said Mrs. Williams, avoiding her daughter's eyes. "Ah, the jasmine. Pray step into the drawing-room. Dr. Maturin and I have a file in there, and he's the fellow to tell you all about jasmine." The winter drawing-room at Melbury Lodge was a handsome, 5-sided room with 2 walls opening onto the garden, and at the far end there stood a light-coloured pianoforte surrounded by sheets of music and covered by many more. Stephen Maturin rose from behind the piano, bowed, and stood silently watching the visitors. He was wearing a black coat so old that it was green in places, and he hadn't shaved for 3 days. From time to time he passed his hand over his rasping jaw. "Why, you're musicians, I declare!" cried Mrs. Williams. "Violins? A cello? How I love music! Symphonies, cantatas! Do you touch the instrument, sir?" she asked Stephen. She didn't usually notice him, for Dr. Vining had explained that naval surgeons were often poorly qualified and always badly paid, but she was feeling well disposed today. "I have just been picking out this piece, ma'am," said Stephen, "but the piano is sadly out of tune."
"I think not, sir," said Mrs. Williams. "It was the most expensive instrument to be had, the Clementi. I remember its coming by the wagon as though it were yesterday."
"Pianos do go out of tune, mamma," murmured Sophia.
"Not Clementi's pianos, my dear," said Mrs. Williams with a smile.
"They are the most expensive in London.
Clementi supplies the court,"
she added, looking reproachful, as though they had been wanting in loyalty.
"Besides, sir," she said, turning to Jack, "it was my eldest daughter who painted the case. The pictures are in the Chinese taste."
"That clinches it, ma'am," cried Jack. "It would be an ungrateful instrument that fell off, having been decorated by Miss Williams. We were admiring the landscape with the pagoda this morning, were we not, Stephen?"
"Yes,"
said Stephen, lifting the adagio of Hummel's D major sonata off the lid. "This was the bridge and tree and pagoda that we liked so much." It was a charming thing, the size of a tea tray. Pure, sweet lines, muted, gentle colours that might have been lit by an innocent moon. Embarrassed, as she so often was, by her mother's strident voice, and confused by all this attention, Sophia hung her head. With a self-possession that she neither felt nor seemed to feel, she said, "Was this the piece he was playing, sir? Mr. Tyndall has made me practice it over and over again." She moved away from the piano, carrying the sheets, and at this point the drawing-room was filled with activity.
Mrs. Williams protested that she would neither sit down nor take any refreshment whatsoever. Preserved Killick and John Whitsoever, able seamen, brought in tables, trays, urns, more coal. Francis whispered what ho for ship's biscuit and a swig of rum to make Cecilia giggle. And Jack slowly began shepherding Mrs. Williams and Stephen out of the room through the French windows in the direction of what he took to be the jasmine. The true jasmine, however, proved to be on the library wall. And so it was from outside the library windows that Jack and Stephen heard the familiar notes of the adagio, as silvery and remote as a musical box. It was absurd how the playing resembled the painting. Light, ethereal, tenuous. Stephen Maturin winced at the flat A and the shrill C, and at the beginning of the first variation he glanced uneasily at Jack to see whether he too was jarred by the mistaken phrasing. But Jack seemed wholly taken up with Mrs. Williams' account of the planting of the shrub, a minute and circumstantial history. Now there was another hand on the keyboard. The adagio came out over the sparse wintry lawn with a fine ringing tone, inaccurate but strong and free. There was harshness in the tragic first variation, a real understanding of what it meant. "How well dear Sophia plays," said Mrs. Williams, leaning her head to one side. "Such a sweetly pretty tune, too."
"Surely that is not Miss Williams, ma'am," cried Stephen.
"Indeed it is, sir," cried Mrs. Williams. "Neither of her sisters can go beyond the scales, and I know for a fact that Mrs. Villers cannot read a note. She wouldn't apply herself to the drudgery." And as they walked back to the house through the mud, Mrs. Williams told them what they should know about drudgery taste and application. Mrs. Villers started up from the piano, but not so quickly as to escape Mrs. Williams' indignant eye. An eye so indignant that it did not lose its expression for the rest of the visit. It even outlasted Jack's announcement of a ball in commemoration of the Battle of St. Vincent, and the gratification of being the first guests to be bespoke. "You recall Sir John Jervis's action, ma'am, off Cape St. Vincent? The 14th of February, 97, St. Valentine's Day?" "Certainly I do, sir. But," with an affected simper, "of course, my girls are too young to remember anything about it. Pray, did we win?"
"Of course we did, mamma," hissed the girls.
"Of course we did," said Mrs. Williams. "Pray, sir, was you there, or was you present?"
"Yes, ma'am," said Jack. "I was third of the Orion. And so I always like to celebrate the anniversary of the battle with all the friends and shipmates I can bring together. And seeing there's a ballroom here..."
"You may depend upon it, my dears," said Mrs. Williams on the way home, "that this ball is being given in compliment to us, to me and my daughters, and I have no doubt that Sophie will open it with Captain Aubrey. St. Valentine's Day, la! Frankie, you've dribbled chocolate all down your front. And if you eat so many rich pastries, you'll come out in spots, and then where will you be? No man will look at you. There must have been a dozen eggs and half a pound of butter in that smaller cake. I've never been so surprised in my life." Diana Villers had been taken, after some hesitation, partly because it would have been indecent to leave her behind, and partly because Mrs. Williams thought there was no possible comparison between a woman with £10,000 and one without £10,000. But further consideration, the pondering of certain intercepted looks, led Mrs. Williams to think that the gentlemen of the Navy might not be so reliable as the local squires and their hard-faced offspring. Diana was aware of most of the motions of her aunt's mind.
and after breakfast the next day she was quite prepared to follow her into her room for a little chat, my dear. But she was quite unprepared for the bright smile and the repeated mention of the word horse. Hitherto it had always meant Sophia's little chestnut mare. How good-natured of Sophie to lend you her horse again. I hope it's not too tired this time, poor thing. But now the suggestion, the downright offer, wrapped in many words, was of a horse for herself. It was a clear bribe to leave the field clear. It was also meant to overcome Sophia's reluctance to deprive her cousin of the mare, and thus to go riding with Captain Aubrey or Dr. Maturin herself. Diana accepted the bait, spat out the hook with contempt, and hurried away to the stables to consult with Thomas, for the great horse fair at Marston was just at hand. On the way she saw Sophia coming along the path that led through the park to Grope, Admiral Haddock's house. Sophia was walking fast, swinging her arms and muttering, "Larboard, starboard," as she came. "Yo-ho, shipmate!" called Diana over the hedge, and she was surprised to see her cousin blush cherry pink. The chance shot had gone straight home, for Sophia had been browsing in the Admiral's library, looking at Navy lists, Naval Memoirs, Falconer's Dictionary of the Marine and the Naval Chronicle. And the Admiral, coming up behind her in his list slippers, had said, "Oh, the Naval Chronicle, is it? This is the one you want," pulling out the volume of 1801. "Though Miss Dye has been before you, forestalled you long ago, made me explain the weather gauge and the difference between a Zeebeck and a brig. There's a little cut of the action, but the fellow didn't know what he was about, so he put in a great quantity of smoke to hide the rigging, which is most particular in a Zeebeck. Come, let me find it for you." "Oh, no, no, no," said Sophia in great distress. "I only wanted to know a little about..." Her voice died away. The acquaintance ripened. But it did not mature. It did not progress as fast as Mrs. Williams would have liked. Captain Aubrey couldn't have been more friendly, perhaps too friendly. There was none of that languishing she longed to see, no pallor, nor even any marked particularity. He seemed to be as happy with Francis as he was with Sophia. And sometimes Mrs. Williams wondered whether he really were quite the thing, whether those strange tales about sea officers might possibly be true in his case. Was it not very odd that he should live with Dr. Maturin? Another thing that troubled her was Diana's horse, for from what she'd heard and from what little she could understand, it seemed that Diana rode better than Sophia. Mrs. Williams could hardly credit this, but even so she was heartily sorry that she had ever made the present. She was in a state of anxious doubts. She was certain that Sophia was moved, but she was equally certain that Sophia would never speak to her of her feelings, just as she was certain that Sophia would never follow her advice about making herself attractive to the gentleman, putting herself forward a little, doing herself justice, reddening her lips before she came into the room. Had she seen them out one day with young Mr. Edward Saville's pack, she would have been more anxious still. Sophia didn't really care for hunting. She liked the gallops, but she found the waiting about dull, and she minded terribly about the poor fox.
Her mare had spirit, but no great stamina, whereas Diana's powerful, short-coupled bay gelding had a barrel like a vault of a church and an unconquerable heart. He could carry Diana's 8 stone from morning till night, and he loved to be in at the kill. They had been hunting since 10:30, and now the sun was low. They had killed 2 foxes, and the third, a barren vixen, had led them a rare old dance, right away into the heavy country beyond Plympton, with its wet plough, double oxes, and wide ditches. She was now only 1 field ahead, failing fast and heading for a drain, she knew. At the last check, Jack had a lucky inspiration to bear away right-handed, a shortcut that brought him and Sophia closer to hounds than anyone in the field. But now there was a bank, a towering fence, mud in front of it, and the gleam of broad water beyond. Sophia looked at the jump with dismay, put her tired horse at it without any real wish to reach the other side, and felt thankful when the mare refused it. She and her mount were quite done up. Sophia had never felt so tired in her life. She dreaded the sight of the fox being torn to pieces, and the pack had just hit off the line again. There was a deadly, implacable triumph in the voice of the old bitch that led them. "The gate! The gate!" called Jack, wheeling his horse and cantering to the corner of the field. He had it half open, an awkward, sagging, left-handed gate, when Stephen arrived. Jack heard Sophia say, "Should like to go home. Pray, pray, go on. Know the way perfectly." The piteous face wiped away his look of frustration. He lost his fixed, borders-away expression, and smiling very kindly, he said, "I think I'll turn back too. We've had enough for today." "I will see Miss Williams home," said Stephen. "No, no, please go on," begged Sophia, with tears brimming in her eyes. "Please, please. I'm perfectly..." A quick drumming of hooves, and Diana came into the field. Her whole being was concentrated on the fence and what lay beyond it, and she saw them only a vague group, muddling in a gate. She was sitting as straight and supple as if she'd been riding for no more than 30 minutes. She was part of her horse, completely unaware of herself. She went straight at the fence, gathered her horse just so, and with a crash and a spray of mud they were over. Her form, her high-held head, her contained joy, competent, fierce gravity, were as beautiful as anything Jack or Stephen had ever seen. She had not the slightest notion of it, but she had never looked so well in her life. The men's faces, as she flew over high and true, would have made Mrs. Williams more uneasy by far. Mrs. Williams longed for the day of the ball. She made almost as many preparations as Jack, and Mapes Court was filled with gauze, muslins, and taffeta. Her mind was filled with stratagems, one of which was to get Diana out of the way for the intervening days. Mrs. Williams had no defined suspicions, but she smelt danger, and by means of 6 intermediaries and as many letters, she managed to have a mad cousin left unattended by his family. She could not do away with the invitation, publicly given and accepted, however, and Diana was to be brought back to Champflower by one of Captain Aubrey's guests on the morning of February 14. "Dr. Maturin is waiting for you, Di," said Cecilia. "He's walking his horse up and down in a fine new bottle-green coat with a black collar, and he has a new tie-wig. I suppose that's why he went up to London." "You've made another conquest, Di. He used to be quite horrid and all unshaved." "Stop peering from behind that curtain like a housemaid, Sissy. And lend me your hat, will you?" "Why, he's quite splendid now," said Cecilia, peering still and puckering the gauze. "He has a spotted waistcoat, too. Do you remember when he came to dinner in carpet slippers? He really would be almost handsome if he held himself up.
A fine conquest, said Mrs. Williams, peering too. A penniless naval surgeon, somebody's natural son, and a papist. Fie upon you, sister, to say such things.
Good morning, Maturin, said Diana, coming down the steps. I hope I've not kept you waiting. What a neat cob you have there, upon my word. You never found him in this part of the world.
Good morning, fellas. You're late. You are very late.
It is the one advantage there is in being a woman. You do know I am a woman, Maturin.
I am obliged to suppose it, since you affect to have no notion of time. Cannot tell what o'clock it is, though why the trifling accident of sex should induce a sentient being, let alone such an intelligent being as you, to waste half this beautiful clear morning, I cannot conceive. Come, let me help you to mount. Sex. Sex.
Hush, Maturin. You mustn't use words like that here. It was bad enough yesterday.
Yesterday? Oh, yes, but I'm not the first man to say that wit is the unexpected copulation of ideas. Far from it. It's commonplace.
As far as my aunt is concerned, you're certainly the first man who ever used such an expression in public. They rode up Hebden Down. A still brilliant morning with a little frost. The creak of leather, the smell of horse, steaming breath.
I am not in the least degree interested in women as such, said Stephen, only in persons. There's Paul Carey,
he added, nodding over the valley. That's where I first saw you on your cousin's chestnut. Let's ride over there tomorrow. I can show you a remarkable family of party-coloured stoats. A congregation of stoats. I must cry off for tomorrow, said Diana. I'm so sorry. I have to go to Dover to look after an old gentleman who's not quite right in the head. A sort of cousin.
But you would be back for the ball, sure,
cried Stephen.
Oh, yes, it's all arranged, and Mr. Babington is to take me up on his way.
Didn't Captain Aubrey tell you?
I was back very late last night, and we hardly spoke this morning. But I must go to Dover myself next week. May I come and beg for a cup of tea?
Indeed you may. Mr. Lowndes imagines he's a teapot. He crooks one arm like this for the handle, holds out the other for the spout, and says, "May I have the pleasure of pouring you a cup of tea? You couldn't come to a better address." But you also have to go to town again, do you not?
I do, from Monday till Thursday.
She reined in her horse to a walk, and with a hesitation and a shyness that changed her face entirely, giving it a resemblance to Sophia's, she said, "Maturin, may I beg you to do me a kindness?"
"Certainly," said Stephen, looking straight into her eyes, and then quickly away at the sight of the painful emotion in them.
"You know something of my position here, I believe. Would you sell this bit of jewellery for me? I must have something to wear at the ball."
"What must I ask for it?"
"Would they not make an offer, do you think? If I could get £10, I should be happy. And if they should give so much, then would you be even kinder and tell Harrison in the Royal Exchange to send me this list immediately? Here's a pattern of the stuff. It could come by the mail coach as far as Lewes, and the carrier could pick it up. I must have something to wear."
"Something to wear.
Unpicked, taken in, let out, and folded in tissue paper, it lay in the trunk that stood waiting in Mr. Lowndes' hall on the morning of the 14th.
"Mr. Babington to see you, ma'am," said the servant.
Diana hurried into the parlour. Her smile faded. She looked again, and lower than she would have thought possible, she saw a figure in a three-caped coat that piped,
"Mrs. Villiers, ma'am, Babington reporting, if you please, ma'am."
"Oh, Mr. Babington, good morning. How do you do?"
"'Captain Aubrey tells me you will be so very kind "'as to take me with you to Melbury Lodge. "'When do you please to start? "'We must not let your horse take cold. "'I've only a little trunk. "'It's ready by the front door. "'You will take a glass of wine before we leave, sir? "'Or I believe you see officers like rum.' "'A tot of rum to keep out the cold would be prime. "'You'll join me, ma'am. "'It's uncommon park here.'
"'A very little glass of rum, and put a great deal of water in it,' whispered Diana to the servant.
But the girl was too flustered by the presence of a strange dog-cart in the courtyard to understand the word water, and she brought a dark brown brimming tumbler that Mr. Babington drank off with great composure. Diana's alarm increased at the sight of the tall, dashing dog-cart and the nervous horse, all white of eye and laid-back ears.
"'Where is your groom, sir?' she asked. "'Is he in the kitchen?'
"'There ain't a groom in this crew, ma'am,' said Babington, now looking at her with open admiration. "'I navigate myself. May I give you a leg up, your foot on this little step, and heave away? Now, this rug, we make it fast aft with these beckets. All a tanto. Let go by the head,' he called to the gardener, and they dashed out of the forecourt, giving the white-painted post a shrewd knock as they passed. Mr. Babington's handling of the whip and the reins raised Diana's dismay to a new pitch. She had been brought up among horse soldiers, and she had never seen anything like this in her life. She wondered how he could possibly have come all the way from Arundel without a spill. She thought of her trunk behind, and when they left the main road, winding along the lanes, sometimes mounting the bank and sometimes shaving the ditch's edge, she said, "It will never do. This young man will have to be taken down." The lane ran straight uphill, rising higher and higher, with God knows what breakneck descent to the other side. The horse slowed to a walk. The bean-fed horse, as it proved by a thunderous, long, long fart.
"'I beg your pardon,' said the midshipman in the silence.
"'Oh, that's all right,' said Diana coldly. "'I thought it was the horse.'
A sideways glance showed that this had settled Babington's hash for the moment.
"'Let me show you how we do it in India,' she said, gathering the reins and taking his whip away from him. But once she'd established contact with the horse and had him going steadily along the path he should follow, Diana turned her mind to winning back Mr. Babington's kindness and goodwill. Would he explain the blue, the red, and the white squadrons to her? The weather gauge? Tell her about life at sea in general? Surely it must be a very dangerous, demanding service, though, of course, so highly and so rightly honoured, the country's safeguard. Could it be true that he'd taken part in the famous action with the Cacafuego? Diana couldn't remember a more striking disparity of forces. Captain Aubrey must be very like Lord Nelson.
"Oh, yes, ma'am," cried Babington, "though I doubt even Nelson could have brought it off so handsome. He's a prodigious man. Though by land, you know, he's quite different. You'd take him for an ordinary person, not the least coldness or distance. He came down to our place to help my uncle in the election, and he was as jolly as a grig. Knocked down a couple of Whigs with his stick. They went down like ninepins. Both of them poachers and Methodists, of course. Though it was such fun, and at Melbury he let me and old Pullings choose our horses and ride a race with him. 3 times round the paddock and the horse to be ridden upstairs into the library for a guinea a side and a bottle of wine. Oh, we all love him, ma'am, although he's so taut at sea."
"Who won?"
"Oh, well," said Babington, "we all fell off more or less at different times, though I dare say he did it on purpose not to take our money."
They stopped to bait at an inn, and with a meal and a pint of ale inside him, Babington said,
"I think you're the prettiest girl I've ever seen. You're to change in my room, which I'm very glad of now. And if I'd known it was you, I should have bought a pincushion and a large bottle of scent."
"You're a very fine figure of a man too, sir," said Diana. "I'm so happy to be travelling under your protection."
Babington's spirits mounted to an alarming degree. He had been brought up in a service where enterprise counted for everything, and presently it became necessary to occupy his attention with the horse. She had meant to allow him only the dash up the drive, but in the event he held the reins all the way from Newton Priors to the door of Melbury Lodge, where he handed her down in state to the admiration of 24 naval eyes. There was something about Diana, a certain piratical dash and openness that was very attractive to sea officers. But they were also much attracted by the two Miss Simmonses' doll-like prettiness, by Frances dancing down the middle with the tip of her tongue showing as she kept the measure, by Cecilia's commonplace healthy good looks, and by all the other charms that were displayed under the blaze of candles in the long, handsome ballroom. And they were moonstruck by Sophia's grace as she and Captain Aubrey opened the ball. Sophia had on a pink dress with a gold sash, and Diana said to Stephen Maturin, "She's lovely. There's not another woman in the room to touch her. That is the most dangerous colour in the world. But with her complexion, it's perfect. I'd give my eye teeth for such a skin. The gold and the pearls help," said Stephen. "The one echoes her hair and the other her teeth. I'll tell you a thing about women. They are superior to men in this, that they have an unfeigned, objective, candid admiration for good looks in other women, a real pleasure in their beauty. Yours, too, is a most elegant dress. Other women admire it. I've remarked this, not only from their glances, but most positively by standing behind them and listening to their conversation. It was a good dress. A light, flimsy version of the naval blue with white about it. No black. No concessions to Mrs. Williams, for it was understood that at a ball any woman was allowed to make the best of herself. But where taste, figure, and carriage are equal, a woman who can spend 50 guineas on her dress will look better than one who can only spend 10 pounds. "We must take our places," said Diana, a little louder, as the second violin struck in and the ballroom filled with sound. It was a fine sight, hung with bunting in the naval way. The signal engaged the enemy more closely, among other messages understood by the sailors alone. Shining with beeswax and candlelight, crowded to the doors, and the lane of dancing figures. Pretty dresses, fine coats, white gloves, all reflected in the French windows and in the tall looking-glass behind the band. The whole neighbourhood was there, together with a score of new faces from Portsmouth, Chatham, London, or wherever the peace had cast them on shore. They were all in their best clothes, they were all determined to enjoy themselves, and so far they were succeeding to admiration. Everyone was pleased, not only by the rarity of a ball, not above 3 in the season in those parts, apart from the assembly, but by the handsome, unusual way in which it was done, by the seamen in their blue jackets and pigtails, so very unlike the greasy hired waiters generally to be seen, and by the fact that for once there were more men than women, men in large numbers, all of them eager to dance. Mrs. Williams was sitting with the other parents and chaperones by the double doors into the supper-room, where she could rake the whole line of dancers, and her red face was nodding and smiling. Significant smiles. Emphatic nods. As she told her cousin Simmons that she had encouraged the whole thing from the beginning. Crossing over in the dance, Diana saw her triumphant face. And the next face she saw, immediately in front of her, was Jack's, as he advanced to hand her about.
such a lovely ball, Aubrey," she said with a flashing smile. He was in gold-laced scarlet, a big, commanding figure. His forehead was sweating and his eyes shone with excitement and pleasure. He took her in with benevolent approval, said something meaningless but kind, and whirled her about. "Come and sit down," said Stephen at the end of the second dance. "You're looking pale."
"Am I?" she cried, looking intently into a mirror. "Do I look horrible?"
"You do not. But you must not get overtired. Come and sit down in a fresher air. Come into the orangery."
"I've promised to stand up with Admiral James. I'll come after supper."
Deserting the supper table, three sailors, including Admiral James, pursued Diana into the orangery. But they withdrew when they saw Stephen waiting for her there with her shawl.
"I didn't think the doctor had it in him," said Mowat. "In the Sophie, we always looked on him as a sort of monk."
"Damn him," said Pullings. "I thought I was getting on so well."
"You're not cold?"
asked Stephen, tucking the shawl round her shoulders.
And as though the physical contact between his hand and her bare flesh established a contact, sending a message that had no need of words, he felt the change of current. But in spite of the intuition, he said, "Diana?"
"Tell me," she said in a hard voice, cutting right across him, "is that Admiral James married?"
"He is."
"I thought so. You can smell the enemy a great way off."
"Enemy?"
"Of course, don't be a fool, Maturin. You must know that married men are the worst enemies women can have. Get me something to drink, will you? I'm quite faint with all that fug."
"This is Sillery, this iced punch."
"Thank you. They offer what they call friendship, or some stuff of that kind, the name don't matter, and all they want in return for this great favour is your heart, your life, your future, your... I will not be coarse, but you know very well what I mean. There's no friendship in men. I know what I'm talking about, believe me. There is not one round here, from old Admiral Haddock to that young puppy of a curate who hasn't tried it, to say nothing of India. Who the devil do they think I am?" she exclaimed, drumming on the arm of her chair. "The only honest one was Southampton, who sent an old woman from Madras to say he would be happy to take me into keeping. And upon my honour, if I'd known what life in England, in this muddy hole with nothing but beer-swilling rustics, was going to be, I should have been tempted to accept. What do you think my life is like without a sou and under the thumb of a vulgar, pretentious, ignorant woman who detests me? What do you think it's like looking into this sort of future with my looks going, the only thing I have? Listen, Magdalen, I speak openly to you because I like you. I like you very much, and I believe you have a kindness for me. You are almost the only man I've met in England I can treat as a friend, trust as a friend."
"You have my friendship, sure," said Stephen heavily. After a long pause, he said, with a fair attempt at lightness, "You are not altogether just. You look as desirable as you can. That dress, particularly the bosom of that dress, would inflame Saint Anthony, as you know very well. It is unjust to provoke a man and then to complain he is a satyr if the provocation succeeds. You are not amiss upon her promotion, moved by unconscious, instinctive—"
"Do you tell me I'm provocative?" cried Diana.
"Certainly I do. That is exactly what I'm saying. But I do not suppose you know how much you make men suffer. In any case, you are arguing from the particular to the general. You've met some men who wish to take advantage of you, and you go too far. Not all French waiters have red hair."
"They all have red hair somewhere about them, and it shows sooner or later. But I do believe you are an exception, Maturin, and that's why I confide in you. I cannot
tell you what a comfort it is. I was brought up among intelligent men. They were a loose lot on the Madras side and worse in Bombay, but they were intelligent, and oh, how I miss them! And what a relief it is to be able to speak freely after all this swimming in namby-pamby.
Your cousin Sophia is intelligent.
Do you really think so? Well, as a sort of quickness, if you like, but she's a girl. We don't speak the same language. I grant you she's beautiful. She is really beautiful, but she knows nothing. How could she? And I cannot forgive her her fortune. It's so unjust. Life is so unjust.
Stephen made no reply, but fetched her an ice.
The only thing a man can offer a woman is marriage, she went on. An equal marriage. I have about 4 or 5 years, and if I can't find a husband by then, I shall... And where can one be found in this howling wilderness? Do I disgust you very much? I mean to put you off, you know.
Yes, I am aware of your motions, Villiers. You do not disgust me at all. You speak as a friend. You hunt, and your chase has a beast in view.
Well done, Maturin.
You insist upon an equal marriage?
At the very least.
I shall despise a woman so poor-spirited, so wanting in courage as to make a mésalliance. There was a smart little whippersnapper of an attorney in Dover that had the infernal confidence to make me an offer. I've never been so mortified in my life. I'd rather go to the stake or look after the teapot for the rest of my days. Define your beast.
I'm not difficult. He must have some money, of course. Love in a cottage, be damned. He must have some sense. He must not be actually deformed, nor too ancient. Admiral Haddock, for example, is beyond my limit. I don't insist upon it, but I should like him to be able to sit a horse and not fall off too often. And I should like him to be able to hold his wine. You don't get drunk, Maturin. That's one of the things I like about you. Captain Aubrey and half the other men here will have to be carried to bed.
No. I love wine, but I do not find it often affects my judgment. Not often. I drank a good deal this evening, however. As far as Jack Aubrey is concerned, do you not think you may be a little late in the field? I have the impression that tonight may be decisive.
Has he told you anything? Has he confided in you?
You do not speak as you have just spoken to a tattletale of a man, I believe. As far as your knowledge of me goes, it is accurate.
In any case, you're wrong. I know Sophie.
He may make a declaration, but she will need a longer time than this. She need never fear being left on the shelf. It never occurs to her at all, I dare say, and she's afraid of marriage. How she cried when I told her men had hair on their chests. And she hates being managed. That's not the word I want. What is it, Maturin?
Manipulated. Exactly.
She's a dutiful girl. A great sense of duty. I think it rather stupid, but there it is.
But still she finds the way her mother has been arranging and pushing and managing and angling and all this perfectly odious.
You two must have had hogsheads of that grocer's claret forced down your throats.
Perfectly odious.
And she is obstinate. Strong, if you like, under that bread-and-butter way of hers. It'll take a great deal to move her, much more than the excitement of a ball.
She's not attached.
Attached to Aubrey? I don't know. I don't suppose she knows herself.
She likes him. She's flattered by his attentions. And to be sure, he is a husband any woman would be glad to have. Well off, good-looking, distinguished in his profession and with a future before him, unexceptionable family, cheerful, good-natured. But she's entirely unsuited to him. I'm persuaded she is, with her secretive, closed, stubborn nature. He needs someone much more awake, much more alive. They'd never be happy.
She may have a passionate side.
aside you know nothing about or do not choose to see.
Stuff, Maturin. In any case, he needs a different woman and she needs a different man. In a way, you might be much more suited to her if you could stand her ignorance.
So Jack Aubrey might answer?
Yes, I like him well enough. I should prefer a man more, what shall I say, more grown up, less of a boy. Less of a huge boy.
He's highly considered in his profession, as you said yourself just now.
That is neither here nor there. A man may be brilliant in his calling and a mere child outside it. I remember a mathematician, they say he was one of the best in the world, who came out to India to do something about Venus. And when his telescope was taken away from him, he was unfit for civilized life. A blundering schoolboy. He clung to my hand all through one tedious, tedious evening, sweating and stammering. Now, give me the politicos. They know how to live. And they're all reading men, more or less. I wish Aubrey was something of a reading man. More like you. I mean what I say. You're very good company. I like being with you. But he is a handsome fellow.
Look, she said, turning to the window.
There he is, figuring away. He dances quite well, does he not? It's a pity he wants decision.
You would not say that if you saw him taking his ship into action.
I mean in his relations with women. He's sentimental. But still, he would do. Shall I tell you something that'll really shock you, although you are a medical man? I was married, you know. I'm not a girl. And intrigues were as common in India as they are in Paris. There are times when I am tempted to play the fool. Terribly tempted. I dare say I should too if I lived in London and not in this dreary hole.
Tell me, have you reason to suppose that Jack is to your way of thinking?
About our suitability?
Yes.
There are signs that mean a lot to a woman. I wonder he ever looked seriously at Sophie.
He's not interested, I suppose.
Her fortune wouldn't mean a great deal to him. Have you known him long? But I suppose all you naval people have known one another or of another forever.
Oh, I'm no seaman at all. I first met him in Minorca in the year one, in the spring of the year one. I'd taken a patient there for the Mediterranean climate. He died, and I met Jack at a concert. We took a liking to one another, and he asked me to sail with him as his surgeon. I agreed, being quite penniless at the time, and we've been together ever since. I know him well enough to say that as for being interested, concerned for a woman's fortune, there never was a man more unworldly than Jack Aubrey. Maybe I'll tell you a thing about him.
Go on, Stephen. Some time ago he had an unhappy affair with another officer's wife. She had the dash, the style, and the courage he loves, but she was a hard, false woman, and she wounded him very deeply. So virginal modesty, rectitude, principle, you know, have a greater charm for him than they might otherwise have had. Ah, yes, I see. I see now. And you have a begging for her, too. It's no use, I warn you. She would never do a thing without her mother's consent, and that is nothing to do with her mother's being in control of her fortune. It's all duty. And you would never bring my Aunt Williams round in 1,000 years. Still, you may feel on Sophie's side. I have the greatest liking and admiration for her. But no tendre. Not as you would define it. But I am averse to giving pain, Villas, which you are not. She stood up as straight as a wand.
We must go in. I have to dance this next bout with Captain Aubrey, she said, kissing him. I'm truly sorry if I hurt you, Maturin.